I'm Sean Yeo, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 889, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I will not. Coming up in the second hour of the show, of course, it is the infamous, the notorious NWA Sports Report. We're talking NBA playoffs, amongst other things. I'm sure there will be some other items on the agenda as well, with all the usual suspects. That's coming up a little bit later in the second hour, First Edition NWA Sports Report. But now, in this first hour, we dedicate it to the substance of the conference that took place today. It's just winding down, as a matter of fact. The Black Mental Health Alliance's conference, Call to Healing Summit, The Trauma of Racism. On the phone with me, I have two of the conference's powerful contributors. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is a professor at Loyola University of Maryland, an author, public intellectual. Dr. K., good to hear your voice and good to see you earlier today.
Yes, I appreciated you showing up. It was nice having Sean Yost in the house.
Oh, thank you so much. Also on the phone is Brother David Miller. He is founder and CEO of the Dare to Be King Project, Walbrook Warrior. David Miller, welcome back to the show, brother.
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm all right. All right, so I'm going to start with you, K. Wise Whitehead. First of all, that was the first time I ever heard you speak publicly. And the consensus of myself and many people who I talked to was, you are a beast. There's no doubt about that. In the best possible way. So it was great to see you do your thing today. In that context, in particular, the issue of race, the trauma of racism. I'm going to just start from. I'm going to ask you to kind of give us a synopsis, give our listeners a synopsis of what you discussed during your time at the conference.
Okay. So thank you so much for your compliment, first of
sure.
all. And I was on the panel with Dr. Andre Bundley, of course, who works for Baltimore City. People are very aware of his work principal and the fact that he ran for mayor.
Yeah.
And with Dr. Lisa Williams, who works, she's director of equity and inclusion, if I'm not mistaken, for Baltimore County. And so our topic was too important to fail, to reroute the school to prison pipeline.
Right.
And I think we had a very interesting discussion because I think we were all coming from different places.
Absolutely.
Dr. Bundley with his work in the school system, as well as his own personal stories of growing up in Baltimore City and, you know, watching his mother die. And, you know, the fact that he gave this very powerful narrative of how he grew up right beside one guy. They had the same kind of life. They lived in the same kind of place. They had the same kind of activities when they were growing up, all kinds of activities, same kind of work in school. But Dr. Bundley graduated from Penn State, and the other guy graduated from the State Pen.
Right.
So talking about that narrative and what does it mean to make choices. And I think that for Dr. Bundley and I, that is really where we split. Because I enter into the space, as many of you listeners know, as not just a researcher and a historian, and a former Baltimore City school teacher, but also as a mother who considers myself to be kind of on the front line trying to actively turn these policies into practices and procedures.
Right.
And the fact that I believe that young people are suffering in these inner city schools. Are you getting feedback? Am I okay?
I can hear you. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We can hear you perfectly.
Perfect. So I wanted to talk about that today and talk about what I think we can do to dismantle the classroom to prison pipeline that seems to exist solely in inner city public schools where you have a majority of black and brown bodies. and what does that look like? And I offer some solutions, solutions that range from the fact that I think that schools need to hire school-based counselors who are trained in race-based theories and practices to be there so that when young people suffer from traumas, that instead of arresting them, right, which is this kind of first line of action, instead of sending them to, you know, out of the classroom, you send them to a place where they can get some support and to be able to talk through what their experience has been, as well as thinking about ways to do classroom management practices differently. And then I offer some solutions for parents. How do we raise our children to be able to imagine themselves out of their current situation? How do we work from the bottom up while the school system works from the top down, and we meet somewhere in the middle with brilliant and bright and wonderful African-American boys and girls who are prone and poised to be the leaders of the next generation?
But another thing you actually also said, Dr. K, was you mentioned the fact that many of the Baltimore City public schools, the facilities themselves, are in some ways abusive. I mean, you have you have schools that have lead in the water. You have facilities that are run down. You I mean, just basic kind of human elements or that people would like to have just going on an ongoing basis when they go to a place every single day. A lot of our children in Baltimore City public schools don't have those things that we consider just kind of basic necessities. If you go to a place every day where you can't drink the water, that doesn't that send a not so subliminal message to you that maybe your worth is a little bit less than maybe others at other school systems or of other races, quite frankly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I talked a bit about that. And for listeners who are not aware, that there are a number of Baltimore City public schools where there are bars on the window, so students are not getting natural light.
Yeah.
And bars on the window, in a sense, make you feel like you're caged in. I know that because that's the environment where I taught. I felt very constricted having big bars on the window. You're teaching in an environment where there is no air. So on a day like today, when it's 92, 93 degrees, if they choose not to close the schools, then you're teaching in an environment that you can barely breathe in. You're trying to open up a window that has a bar, so you're getting very little air, but you're expecting the children to be well-behaved, to stay in their seats, and to not complain out loud. You're teaching in school systems where if you go into the bathroom, there are no doors on the stalls. And I'm particularly thinking about the bathrooms for females. And even if you talk about trans students, there's no privacy at all.
Right.
There's no toilet tissue in the bathroom. There are no mirrors in the bathroom. I remember I had to, in addition to getting chalk and paper, I bought toilet tissue. I bought hand sanitizer. I mean, I bought, you know, granola bars for students who are coming from homes who didn't have breakfast. This is before they offered free breakfast for everyone. But they also learn how to be controlled by the bell. The bell rings, you wait to be told you can get up, you get in a line, you go to the next classroom. I felt uncomfortable when they, you know, raised their hand, and I get to decide whether or not they really have to use the bathroom, right? Because I can control and figure this out, whereas I go into some of the independent schools where they're bright and airy and there are books for everyone, and the kids can drink the water, and they learn how to get up when they, you know, they learn to tell time and move to the next classroom. They're being trained to be leaders and not trained to operate in what looks like a prison environment.
And to that point, David Miller, you and I have had this conversation today, as a matter of fact. There's a couple of things I want to touch with you, but one of the conversations that we had was one of those independent schools, the Interoma Academy. I know for a fact that the children spent the day outside. They were outside learning in the sunshine. They were drinking water. Then they took a walk to the library. Then they came back. They did more lessons. But they spent the day outside because it was such a beautiful day. And that environment that your son came out of, your son went to Interoma, I believe, correct?
Well, he went to my son and daughter went to Maharifa,
right, the school where, right, yes, yes, yes.
For 30 years, Mama K.
That's right.
Mama Kenyatta was my son and daughter's teacher.
That's
and then
right.
When Mama K passed in Interoma, you know, they opened up Interoma. But you know, the reality is, Sean, and I know you had to leave and you missed my presentation.
Yeah, I didn't get to see it.
Dr. K for just an amazing presentation.
Thank you.
Part of what we got to come to grips with is we may disagree on methods, but we got to come to some kind of consensus that there are severe challenges in the Baltimore City Public Schools that that have to be addressed, whether it's facilities, whether it's leadership and management. You were able to have Tim King on a couple of weeks ago. I talked a little bit in my presentation about Urban Prep, South Side of Chicago.
Right,
they
right,
have
right.
no special admissions requirements. They're in a gang-infested neighborhood. But they realize that they can transform the lives of young people through a school. And I just think that we're not focusing enough energy on how do we improve the schools. And with my specific presentation, I looked at literacy. Mm-hmm. And I looked at books. Nationally, only 12% of African-American males are proficient in reading by eighth grade. Only 12%, according to the National Assessment for Educational Progress. And I think some of that is directly related to content, the books our children are reading. And I'm just blown away that you have school districts like a Baltimore, like in a Newark or Philadelphia, where you have schools that are, you know, over 80% African-American, yet a lot of times the books that teachers are using, a lot of times the books that are recommended on the school summer reading list, oftentimes, you know, you find that only a few of these books are written by African-Americans that uplift African-American stories, that deal with positive self-image, positive self-concept. And so my presentation really looked at, you know, the inherent racism in the children's publishing industry, where only less than 8% of children's books published in this country are written and illustrated by African-Americans. But then what's happening in school districts where you have black superintendents, black principals, who have the autonomy to get these books, and they still don't do it?
Right.
And that was something that was addressed as well during the conference. I mean, that every, you know, to make it plain, every brother and sister ain't a brother and sister, and and that's, you know, that's another piece of the equation. But one of the things that I want to present to both of you, because both of you did well, I David, I know that you offer solutions because you've been solution oriented all of your career, and Kay, you offered solutions during your presentation. But one of the things that I want us to discuss in these last few minutes of this segment is connectivity, because there are people like both of you who are doing incredible work in both of your quadrants of the universe, but in our communities, unfortunately, too often, we don't know what everybody is doing, and there's a lack of cohesion, if you will, in that, and I think that that lack of cohesion, that lack of connectivity, and understanding of what all of the people who are doing the incredible work that they are doing, we do that, or we operate in that way at our own peril. Either one of you can jump in.
Oh, I'm. I was expecting Mr. Miller's comment, but I just want to start, if I can, by saying that I enjoyed his presentation on literacy. I really appreciated what the chord you struck, that if we want to change the way that young people see themselves, they need to see themselves in the literature, see themselves on the wall. I know Ray Wimbush talks a lot about that with the warrior method, exposing African-American boys in particular, but African-American girls as well, to see themselves in the work that they're learning. My sons have an issue in middle school where teachers were complaining when they asked for books by African-American authors. The teacher says, well, I don't really have any. And my son holds up, hit my book and says, well, my mom wrote one. Can we use that one? There are books out here, and we have to empower our children to be able to say, when the teachers don't know what to have, our children should have a ready list and be ready to give that forward to keep the class moving in a good direction. So what the solutions that I'm thinking about and the ways to apply them is something that Dr. Williams said today, where she said, we are the work.
Right.
That, you know, if you talk about doing the work, you are actually the work. If you are conscious, if you are what they call woke, right, in terms of being aware of what's happening right around you, if that is who you are, then the work you're doing has to connect from the research, from the ivory tower, in
to the classrooms. I challenge teachers from Trump Syllabus K-12 to my work training master teachers to be on ground zero where the students are. It's not enough just to change policy. If policy is not being implemented and it's not changing the environment, then nothing is changing except you're feeling better about yourself and students are existing in the same space.
David Miller, I mean, is it realistic for us whether it's realistic or not? I mean, I think it seems like what Dr. K is talking about is if we're gonna look for solutions within public school systems, and we're in Baltimore, so specifically the Baltimore City public school system. You dropped a couple of bombs on me today that I didn't even know, and if you want to share them out, you may. As far as literacy is concerned, as far as in Baltimore City public schools, but we've gotten to a time where we just have to literally explode the public school model in a way. And go into and look into alternative ways of educating our children, because this system that the vast majority of our children are forced to operate within it's not working, I don't think, on a broad scale.
And you know, I mean, some of it is going to take some heavy lifting on the part of community-based organizations, because I think we would all agree that many of the teachers and administrators in schools are absolutely overwhelmed. And so we got to figure out a way, with so many churches in a city like Baltimore, how can we get churches to adopt schools and focus on, literacy projects, doing rites of passage programs in those schools. I mean, how do we leverage those churches? But then the other thing, you know, Sean, and I think we're on the same page. When you look at what Tim King did in Urban Prep, he opened Urban Prep because he realized that in the city of Chicago, they were losing too many black boys to violence and to schools that crushed the intellectual curiosity of black males, right? So they decided, and Tim King is a lawyer by trade, right? David Banks at the Eagle Academy, there's an Eagle Academy in every borough in New York City, and one in Newark, New Jersey. Banks was an attorney, and he was tired of seeing what was happening to young black males in the criminal justice system. So he leveraged his relationship with 100 black men of New York City, and they have opened up, 6-7 schools that are closing the achievement gap among black males in the city of New York. And so as Dr. K said, we just got to do the work. We have to do the work, and particularly when we think about, look at all of this money, Sean and Dr. K, that's being spent in the Baltimore City school system.
Right.
And then you see an article today, and I didn't write the article, but I think it was 8 schools in Baltimore where you don't have any of the children proficient in reading and in math. 8 schools. And I would submit that those are just the 8 that they're telling us about. It's probably 38. Because while there are some great schools doing good work, there's so many schools that hover under the radar screen that are not making the grades. And oftentimes, we just sit by and we know what's happening, but we do nothing.
But listen to 8 schools that have 0%. 0%.
Zero.
Reading and math proficiency of their students. And one of those schools is Douglas High School.
Yes.
Yep.
And we've been focusing a lot on Douglas, you know, with this notion of, you know, what does ground zero mean? I've done teach-ins at Douglas. What's interesting is that Mary Wright Endelman, a few years ago, she put out the statistics, and this is from 2015. And she was saying at that point, you had 54% of fourth grade black boys and girls in this country reading below grade level. They were in fourth grade, and they were not reading on that grade level. And she was saying, if you track what that means, this is not in any way having them on a track for college. You're having them on a track to either drop out, to go to prison, to not be able to finish high school, because every year they're going to fall more and more behind. And it's very rare that a 16-year-old wants to be in the room and can't read what's on the board, can't read what's in the book, and they're going to start behaving in different ways because they don't understand what's going on. That's the level that we need to drill down and talk about what's happening in the elementary school. And why is it that we're training black and brown children at that level not to go on to college? It's happening there. It's not happening in ninth grade. Ninth grade is too late. let's talk about first, second, and third grade, where you really lay down those foundational skills.
Indeed. It just sometimes, you know, I was so thankful for this conference today.
It
was really good. And it was they were tremendous people who spoke and offered their insight and thoughts. But sometimes it feels like this. Many of the issues that we face specifically in Baltimore City, many of the challenges that we face almost seem too big to get our arms around. But we have to negate that, rebuke that feeling and that sense, and do the work, as you all have said today, earlier, and are saying right now. We could talk for hours, but we don't have hours to talk. But I thank both of you for sharing, and again, really wonderful job today.
Thank you, and
thank you both for coming through. David Miller, founder and CEO of the Dare to Be King Project, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, professor at Loyola University of Maryland, author, public intellectual. Thank you both. We appreciate you as always.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation about this conference that took place today. Call to Healing Summit, the Trauma of Racism, took place today. The Black Mental Health Alliance sponsored it. We'll be joined by our friend Chang Bell, life and health coach, and the Black Male Yoga Initiative is his thing. And also we'll be joined by Richard Rowe as well, of the Black Mental Health Alliance. And I believe we're going to talk to Dr. Stacey Patton as well, award-winning journalist and multimedia journalism professor here at Morgan State University. Stay tuned. Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host. We're continuing the conversation that was started today earlier at a conference sponsored by the Black Mental Health Alliance. Call to Healing Summit, the Trauma of Racism, was held today. It just shut down at New Shiloh Baptist Church. In the studio with me is my brother Chang Bell. He is host of the Relation Shift Experience, which airs on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. here on WEAA. He is also the founder of the Black Male Yoga Initiative. Brother, good to see you as always.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be in here with you.
Oh, let's make sure your microphone is on.
I can't hear myself.
There we go.
Mic check, one, two, plug one, plug two. Yes, always a pleasure to be here with you, man.
Absolutely, brother.
That engineer.
Yeah. Also on the phone, we have Dr. Stacey Patton, award-winning journalist, author, child advocate, and assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at Morgan State University. She wrote the book, Spare the Kids, Why Whooping Children Won't Save Black America. It's been released, and we had her on the show talking about it a couple of months ago. Dr. Patton, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for taking time to talk to us about these important issues that were outlined during this conference today. Dr. Patton, I'll start with you. You were part of the conversation with David Miller, who we just had on a moment ago, the topic resiliency and repairing the wounds of childhood trauma. And much of that trauma has been caused, unfortunately, by the way we discipline our children. Speak to what you brought today at the conference. I unfortunately had to leave and wasn't able to hear you, but talk to the listeners about what you shared today.
Yeah, part of my conversation with the attendees was talking about this myth that whipping black children builds resiliency, that it strengthens them, that it prepares them for the harshness of racism in America. And so I tried to demystify that by talking about how whipping children is not native to our culture. It's not something that our West African ancestors did. That it's actually, you know, part of, you know, the trauma of white supremacy. That we beat our kids because this is what a white supremacist system requires us to participate in. And I talked about how it's connected
to educational outcomes, juvenile justice, foster care, contact, you know, a lowered IQ, drug addiction, violence in the streets, and so on and so forth.
Indeed, and it is, and as you outlined when we had you on the show a couple of months ago, it is a complicated issue because so many of us in our community have bought into the notion that sometimes you just gotta, you can't talk to them. You gotta just, and it seems harmless enough in the minds and hearts of people, but great harm can be done. And it's not just physical, you know, hitting. Physical correction. It's just that verbal, emotional abuse that has just been so pervasive, unfortunately, in our communities mm-hmm. over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this notion that you have to be harsh with Black children, that you have to beat them, you know, it actually co-signs the long-standing racist narrative that the only way to make Black people civilized, moral, intelligent, good people is to process their bodies through violence. So when Black people are beating their kids, this is internalized racism. When we say these things about our children, it's internalized racism. And so we don't, you know, it's become so ingrained in our culture that when we say these things, you know, we don't really realize how we are in agreement with massive logic.
Yeah, exactly. Changa Bell, we've had many conversations on this show and personally about the our children and being able to reach them in a way that forces us to transcend previous or kind of other ways that we've attempted to reach them and right. and we talk about bringing yoga into our public schools, helping them to be able to breathe, showing them how to meditate, because ultimately these methods help them get in touch with themselves and get in touch with some of the injuries and hurt that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of what Dr. Patton brought up today in the conference and what David Miller brought up, you know, I live personally as I've chosen to separate myself from a lot of these systems, right? So I homeschool. It's a very hard thing to do on a single income. But I reap the benefits of sleeping well at night, knowing that I'm averting some of the systematic oppression that happens. But then I put my family through unnecessary pain and discomfort because of some of the economic situations we have to go through, et cetera. So, you know, sort of this systematic chess game, if you will, that railroads us into making decisions to acquiesce. I just appreciate that the conference challenged those today. I mean, there was almost a fire at my table because of what Dr. Patton was challenging Christianity as a view and breaking it down. And I appreciate her breaking it down in a historical framework, showing that it's only been about 250 years that we have practiced that religion as slaves. For me, my own understanding of my religion is in the context of faith. And, you know, it doesn't matter really what ideological character you put there. It's just the faith that resonates with me. And, you know, you and I have always sure. talked about that. So whatever you choose. So I'm not sure if I directly answered that, but just in terms of how I approach, you know, sort of the ideological things we spoke about today in action, because I think at the end, and D-Watt, I had to stay there to the end you know, support my brother D. Watkins, is basically we all models for change, and how we live it is going to approach the problem from a multifaceted, you know, and sort of circular approach to solve it. But in that, I think we do need to stand up and support each other and allow for differences of opinion, differences of lifestyle, differences of approach, because it's still going to end that system.
Let me ask you both a broader question about the whole notion of the trauma associated with racism. We know that there is trauma associated with racism. We know it's generational trauma that's been associated with racism. But in the context in which we operate today in 2017, in the political climate, the cultural climate that we operate in, it seems like it's more of a precarious walk to have these conversations, and I would argue to have a broader conversation that involves other ethnic groups outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Patton, can you speak to that challenge and and how to, and from your perspective, in your mind, how we kind of navigate those pathways?
Well, I can't speak for other people, but for me, it's not precarious. Okay. Because I just tell the truth. And, you know, people don't like it. Some people do. Today, you know, a woman approached me, you know, after my session, and, you know, she didn't like my remarks on Christianity and how, you know, our indoctrination into Christianity during slavery, you know, has us buying into this spare the rod, spoil the child, you know, theology that's destructive. And mm-hmm. I had to talk about how, you know, the, you know, Africans who left and were bought here as slavery, as slaves, did not practice Christianity. The first 100 years that we were in this country, our enslaved ancestors did not practice Christianity in any significant numbers. And so she accused me of shaming Christians. And I said, no, I was just giving you the facts of history. And so there's a lot of emotionalism when you lay things out, sometimes from our own people, sometimes from white folks. And so they don't hear what you say. They don't hear the facts. They hear the voices in their own head, you know. And so sometimes you will, you know, people will come at you really hard, not because what you said is wrong per se, but because what you said is so powerful and so truthful that it hits them in, you know, a deeply, you know, insecure place, and then they project all of that onto you. So I see that. I get it when I talk to black folks. I get it when I talk to white people. But I understand what my spiritual mission is, and I'm always prepared. Anywhere that I talk, I'm prepared never to be invited back, because it, for me, it's about truth. That's what this is about. And so when you have that, when you understand that that's your spiritual mission, you're fearless. You walk in any place and you drop your bomb and here it is, now you gotta deal with it.
Understood. Mm-hmm. And along, you know, that, well, I won't say same path. And when we talk about spirituality, just the issue of race itself, there's still a lot of people in this country who don't want to deal with the truth of race and racism as well. Mm-hmm. For instance, the discussion of reparations is one that I've talked about on this show many times and really localized it, just as an example. But Changa Bell, I mean, the navigating that racial discussion, because it's, I mean, we can only, if we have these conversations amongst ourselves, we have to have certain conversations amongst ourselves in order for us to find some results that, the results that we're looking for. I mean, there are issues that we have to deal with within our own communities, but there has to be that broader conversation at some point, at least in my mind. And being able to do that, I don't even know if we as black people, as people of African ancestry, sometimes it doesn't seem like we're ready to have the conversation amongst ourselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I understand the point you're making, I think what I really appreciate is Imhotep right at the end of the conference. He had more of a discussion that is from present forward, more of a strategic discussion. I think the discussions that we have too often are around the dissonance that we feel, the cognitive dissonance of trying to reconcile what it's like to be post-racial, and it's never going to be post-racial because racism is in itself an institution. And one of the things I battle with daily is, you know, trying to express my personal sovereignty and how I feel it and not being supported in that. So, you know, the fact that I could go to that conference today because my business is largely under, you know, utilized, or the facility is underutilized by people of African-American descent. They're not coming through on a daily basis. So I'm seeking ways to differentiate, and that's large in part due to our unawareness or our lack of contextual knowledge. It's not, I won't say that that's, that I own the complete truth in that, but it's one of the reasons. So if we could have more forward and strategic based conversations around our own sovereignty and not necessarily looking for a hand up, or as Dr. Patton had talked about, you know, never accepting the religion of our oppressors. So never, that would go the same as accepting the economic, you know, system that they're trying to hand down, the political system they're trying to hand down. We just have to create our own. And where do we look to for that reference? Well, we look to our own historical context and our own origin.
Dr. Patton, to that point, when we start talking about the historical context of religion and how it was handed down, I mean, when that woman at I mean, I hear you loud and clear. You make your statement, you make it plain, and you have to prepare yourself to not be invited back. But in a context like our community, where so many embrace the Christian, the Christian faith. I'm really trying to balance my words here, because I mean, Changa and I have had these discussions about our faith and what it means to us, and how we've kind of inoculated ourselves seemingly against certain criticism because maybe our understanding is a little bit different. But as you go forward and you tell your truth, and it's received the way it's received, how does that inform you as you go forward? Does it inform you in any different way? Does it help, or is it just you see what you see and you hear what you hear and you know what you know, and that's how you approach it when you go to do conferences like this and other venues?
Well, I'm unshaken. You know, when you do the research, when you read. You know, when you research and you understand, you know, historical genesis of a problem, when you know what the facts are, and a lot of people, once again, they'll come at you and they're totally uninformed. They haven't done any reading. They haven't done any archival research. And I'm not looking down on folks for that because, you know, I'm an educator. My job is to share information. So I share these facts, and what people do with it is none of my business. And so when I get the resistance, I don't take it personally. It's not about me. Once again, you know, it's hard for people to hear that everything you've been taught is a lie, whether it's by your mama, grandmama and them, your pastor. Like, I get it, and so people hear that truth, and it triggers something in them, and then they're in their emotions because they think you are disrespecting them, that you're talking about them. But eventually, once they get out of their emotions, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll come around. But it's my job, you know, as somebody who made, you know, a spiritual contract with my ancestors to talk about this, that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And not everybody's going to be open to your message. What keeps me going are the parents who write to me and say, you know what, I read something you wrote, or, you know, I heard you speak on the radio or whatever, and I've reconsidered the way that I parent my child. For me, that is everything. That's everything. So for every, you know, one person, one who's a dissenter, you might be 10 more who come at you and say, I'm going to do something different. And that's where I get my energy from and will to keep going.
Understood. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo's, your host. We're talking about the conference that just wound down today at New Shiloh Baptist Church, called a Healing Summit, the Trauma of Racism, sponsored by the Black Mental Health Alliance. On the phone, we are talking to Dr. Stacey Patton, award-winning journalist, author, child advocate, and assistant professor of multimedia journalism here at Morgan State University. Also in the studio with me is Brother Changa Bell. He is host of the Relation Shift Experience here on WEA Wednesday night, 7 p.m. He is also the founder of the Black Male Yoga Initiative. Changa, I'm going to come back to you and delve a little bit deeper in the work that you do with the Black Male Yoga Initiative and how it is affecting, touching specifically young Black men, some of the most vulnerable, I guess is the word I want to use, in our city. For those who don't know and don't remember the conversations that we've had when you were a co-host on my show, help our listeners, help them refresh their memories as far as that the approach that you've had and some of the results that you've had in getting young men to really kind of open up, for lack of a better term, and see things a little bit differently as far as how they deal with some of the traumas that they've had to deal with in this city,
Yeah. I think, so the mission of the Black Male Yoga Initiative is to train black men, 16 African-American men, because, black really is to categorizing us, but African-American men ages 16 to 65 to be registered yoga teachers. And the hope is that through that process of self-realization, that some kind of change would happen and each one would teach one and become pillars or leaders in their community in some sort of spiritual context, some sort of by touching the grace within them. So whether they propagate that through Christianity, Muslim religion, whatever it is, just getting in touch with that creator inside of them would help change the community. Interestingly enough, here in Baltimore, because I'm black, I get railroaded toward the kids more, but I have an interest in touching 40-year-old black men just as much as the youth. And I think it's sort of an odd question I get asked often as soon as I say I'm a black yoga teacher, I'm certified in two different types of yoga, Georgetown certified health coach, et cetera, that they say, oh, well, do you operate in the prisons? And, I don't know where that comes from, but it's just an interesting question that somehow I get associated with the prison system. And I spent my life trying to stay out of prison. And so I don't want to go in for any reason, really. But to reach, so the work I do largely with foster kids and juvenile offenders, I mean, I find it really gratifying and meaningful because a lot of us spoke about it today that our young men don't get a chance to be kids often. And that across the board, I don't know who it was that brought up that statistic that when compared to their white counterparts that visually people always 100% of the time selected the black child to be a lot older than he was,
right.
He or she was. Just giving them a vulnerable space of trust, non-judgment. So when they, for instance, when the other day a kid was talking about being chased by the cops, he had to throw his burner in the bushes before coming to class. Now, it is not my role to drop dime on that person to judge him or, him and give him that. It's just to then start to reframe his mindset, to get him to speak about it, to use motivational interviewing, to get him to speak about it and see his own feelings about how he feels about himself in that moment. It's not up to me to start to say, well, you're wrong for doing this. Who are you going to kill with that, et cetera, et cetera. I just ask, so how does that make you feel? What are you going to do later? He said, oh, I'm going to go pick it back up because it's a part of his profession right now as a hustler on the street. So it's really just earning that trust so that I can then be a guide and an advisor. So I find it meaningful because that they need to be heard first. They can't be pontificated to. It's having a conversation with. That little conjunction makes a lot of difference, to and with. With there's a certain amount of respect and a certain amount of empathetic listening that will allow for true healing and true change, in my opinion.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Patton, especially from your perspective as a multimedia journalism professor here at Morgan State University. You talk about the physical trauma that our children endure when they're being disciplined and have endured over generations. We see manifesting in the 21st century another type of trauma through media, through music, through videos, through news, through so many different sources, the internet. What is your advice to parents in trying to help guide them in helping their children navigate those treacherous pathways of this burgeoning, this exploding multimedia culture that we live in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much toxic stuff on the internet that children are taking into their brains. And I actually see it, see the symptoms of it in my classrooms at Morgan.
Right.
I have students who haven't, who are coming to us less and less literate. Mm-hmm. I have students who spend so much time in the digital culture that it's literally changed the physical architecture of their brain. To the point where their critical thinking skills have been harmed. They don't have their own questions. They don't know how to research. They don't know how to write. Their attention span is just, it's bad. I give a 5-page article to read, but they struggle with it. And, there's also, we've seen an uptick in something called digi-punishment. Parents who are shaming and beating their kids on the internet and uploading them to sites like WorldStar, Hip Hop,
wow.
YouTube, live link and so on. So we have this whole culture of shaming children. So people get to, you know, share these videos millions of times, like them, and so on and so forth. And people engage in this really toxic conversation about our children's behavior and character. And so if they're in this sort of digital smog of messaging, you know, and they take that in, you know, meanwhile being treated as if their voices don't matter, if their thoughts don't matter, if their questions don't matter. So people like to lecture at young people about using the internet responsibly, but you have adults, you know, being irresponsible in their treatment of children online. And on top of that, we have a culture that's not media literate. There's so much violence in our digital culture. There's so much violence in our political discourse as well. I mean, look at who our president is, for goodness sake. So there's so much of that, and we haven't stopped to think about what this is doing to our children's brain, to their humanity, and how it's had this kind of numbing effect. Particularly, we saw this with all these police shootings that get recorded and passed around on Facebook. So it just, it's become so, you know, so much part of our culture that we as a people have become numb and not moved to activism to get justice for people who are victims of police brutality.
A whole nother conversation right there, mm-hmm. actually. Yep. Let's take some phone calls before we finish, though. Let's go to Big Al first in Baltimore. Big Al, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I'm an old man, but I think I want to audit that woman's course because, I mean, she speaks straight to my heart. I mean, you know, like, it's almost impossible to correct our whole situation without understanding and knowing what she's talking about. Well, she hits everything 100% on the mark. As a matter of fact, What she has said over the air should be mandatory for every student that goes into Morgan to attend her lectures. And I have to close on that. You know, I mean, that's, I mean, the woman, doctor, you are a shining light in darkness.
Tell us how you really feel, Big Al.
I appreciate your kindness, Big Al. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Big Al. We appreciate you, man.
Yeah, that was awesome.
It was awesome. Let's go to Brother Leo Burrows in Bolton Hill. Brother Burrows, you're on First Dish. How you doing?
My friends, I'm thinking of how enlightened self-determination is accentuated by your guests. Obviously, when you talk about looking at our situation in a definitive, constructive, and enlightened way, we have to go in the direction that she's espousing. And certainly, I would remind everyone, and we don't want to hear it, that traditional tribal worship and spirituality have long been ignored in teachings, and that Christianity was something that enslaved people were indoctrinated and forced to accept. And again, sometimes we forget that, but we've got to examine that in light of the need to bring change in our society and, in fact, to bring the revolution in a revolutionary way. And we seem to be on a treadmill and not able to break free from the slave master's doctrines as relates to religion. So we've got to think anew. And thank you. Thanks to your guests. That's going to help us a great deal.
Thank you, Brother Burrows. And I mean, a lot of love, Dr. Batten, for you.
Glad he said he made that point. I mean, today about a quarter of the room got up and left when I said,
really?
Black people will not be free unless we have the courage to reject our oppressive God. And, you know, there were people who did not, they were not feeling that. And what that actually means, that we need to stop as black people and ask ourselves, what were we before this? Mm-hmm. Who would we be had we not become the people that we are now? How are these systems, you know, toxic to us?
how are they counterintuitive, counterproductive? Are they really getting us to a place of emotional emancipation, political and economic, you know, independence? You know, we've been doing some very toxic things since the plantation. They're not working for us. They're not freeing us. And if we are worshiping, you know, if we are taking hold of a religion that was taught to us by our oppressors, and it's not helping us improve our communities, our families, and strengthen us as individuals, then we need to throw it out and make something new.
Understood. Your position is understood, Dr. Patton. And we're not gonna do that for
a whole nother hour.
Yeah, we have 1 minute left, so we're not gonna resolve much.
That sounds like something that needs to be on the relationship. I think I'm gonna steal her over to that hour.
I wouldn't. I think it would be a great conversation. It would be a great conversation. But I appreciate you both for taking time to talk about this conference that I think was really needed. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice if we only talk to people who agree 100% with everything that we say.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Patton, I thank you for taking your time
to talk
to us.
I appreciate both of you.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate you.
Yeah.
And Brother Changabell, you know I appreciate you, brother.
Yeah, thank you,
sir. The coach, the host of the Relationship Shift Experience airs on Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. Right here on WEAA. Thank you, brother. Good to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you too, doctor.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, second hour of First Edition, NWA Sports Report coming up. Stay tuned. Thank you.